On the Empire Podcast this week, we ask Neil Jordan all about Greta.
The fact that it wasn't overtly sexual, I thought was really kind of refreshing. I'm a bit tired of sex. Maybe it's my age, you know.
And Andrew Scott comes in to talk about hot priests looking for love in our area. Wait. No, apparently it's about his new film, Steel Country, which is out this week.
It was great. I pretended it's method that I just ate ice cream basically for breakfast for 6 weeks. Pretended I was
and lunch and dinner.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, yeah. So it was a real experience.
All this plus the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that is getting into the Easter spirit by hiding eggs all over the office. Sadly, they turned out to be alien eggs and we've lost several colleagues to facehuggers. But at least we're in the Easter spirit, so that's something. Hello, Pod. I'm Helen O'Hara, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. Chris Hewitt is once again away gallivanting around for no reason. But never fear, because I'm nevertheless joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning, as is traditional. First up, we have Nick DeSemlin, a man who enjoys an egg as long as it's a dinosaur egg. Isn't that right, Edmund?
I do. I love a dinosaur egg, unless a raptor's in it and it bites your face off. Have you guys seen the advert for the Universal Studios Jurassic World ride, which is opening this week, I think?
It is very exciting.
Have you seen this? It's like chasing like all kinds of people through Universal Studios. It is very cool. I need to go on that ride immediately.
Have you been on the old one with the T-Rex and the sort of, it's a water ride going through on a boat?
Many times.
Yeah, but this has to like...
It's got a big drop.
And
I hope they have kept that big drop intact, but with an animatronic Edmund. I've insisted on it.
You have. I was going to say, have you? Yeah.
And they weren't returned.
They haven't gone back to you?
Not yet, but I'm assuming they're busy building the animatronic version of me.
Exactly. They're probably just trying to get the money together to pay for your rights to your face.
It's expensive.
Of course. And next up, we have our West Wing guru, James Dyer, who has promised to wear bunny ears throughout this entire recording if we allow him to plug pilot for 10 seconds.
Well, actually, you have a double pilot thing, because last week, I was away. I was in Chicago for Star Wars Celebration.
You've never mentioned it.
Which I'm sure I will tell you about very, very shortly. But while I was away, Nick replaced me on the Pilot TV podcast. You were substitute James, weren't you?
I did, a much better model Android.
You were a lot better. How did you find it?
It was daunting, but I tried my best to supply Picard news, as people are hoping for.
So if my presence was not enticement enough to come and listen to the Pilot TV podcast, do listen to the latest one, because it has Nick instead. And, you know, you will prefer
him
anyway.
That does sound better.
Yeah, this is what's going to happen, I guarantee. Like, the stats for Pilot will go through the roof for that one episode that I'm not there.
Well, Edmund has his fans. Yeah, that's true. Why they want him in the ride, you know, so it makes
everyone
sense.
Who watched Jurassic World went and listened to the Pilot TV podcast, I would be a very happy raptor. But yes, no, I was in Chicago for Celebration, and it was insane.
I saw you hanging out with R2-D2.
I did. I met R2-D2. I met BB-8. I met everyone out there.
Did you meet BB-8's new friend?
D.O. I saw D.O. I didn't get to speak to him.
They're not putting any effort into the names anymore, are they?
I love the fact that he's based on a duck. I think that's quite cute. Mm. Like, you saw the concept art, and one of them was just a rubber duck.
I have a rubber duck that's also like Mozart.
Does it also look like a
drawing? I got it in Salzburg. No, it just looks like a rubber duck that looks like Mozart.
Okay. I used to have a rubber duck that looked like Sherlock Holmes, and I called it Sherduck Holmes.
I call mine Amaducus.
Oh, good.
Too many revelations happening in this in this episode.
No, it was a good trip. I already talked about the episode 9 stuff on on our breakdown trailer special.
And that is out now, and you can listen to it as you wish.
It is, indeed. I also saw some Mandalorian stuff, which was fun, and no one got to see that because they cut the footage from the live stream. So I had Werner Herzog in it. Billy Dee Williams was in it. Yeah, that actually looks pretty good.
I'm very happy that Werner Herzog is in it. That's amazing.
Yeah, as an Imperial officer.
Is it true that Werner Herzog says the word parsec?
I believe he does, yes.
That's just the greatest.
He sends the Mandalorian on a trip to pick up a person.
In what context does he use parsec? This is important.
Oh, that's a very good point. I don't remember.
The futility of the parsec.
No, I think, yes, it's just like that. Is he using it in terms of time or distance? That's the question, isn't it? He's Werner Herzog. I'm sure he got it right.
Whichever way we're all going to die in life is meaningless.
It's very true.
His character will explain that in detail.
The nihilism
was
implicit.
Thanks for that, Werner. That's great.
There was also a Phantom Menace 20th anniversary celebration / apology panel.
Ahmed Best, right?
With Ahmed Best. No, but why it was relevant. So it was, on the one hand, it was banging on about Phantom Menace, but Ahmed Best, who famously doesn't really do these sort of things, he had such a horrific time after. I mean, he's written about it, like contemplating suicide, like it's really dark. Like, he had a horrible time from the fandom, and he came out and was embraced really warmly. And like, everyone in the room was incredibly enthusiastic and said how much they loved him. And actually, I think it was like almost a healing process for him with Star Wars. In many ways, it's ironic because these are the same fuckers that hounded him off the internet in the first place and now feel really bad about it.
Well,
But
in fairness, it's been 20 years. This is probably a new generation
of fuckers,
of non-fuckers, of people who were so small when they saw The Phantom Menace that that was their
Star
Wars.
A lot of the fuckers were middle-aged. I think that it's definitely a contingent of the same.
But there is an outpouring of Gungan love.
Yeah,
I feel it.
He's been reevaluated, I think.
Ollie Gibbs, our former designer, was leading that at the forefront. Mm-hmm. Justice for Jar Jar. But yeah, I think it's only a matter of time before we get a Disney Plus Gungan animated series. It's going to happen, guys.
It's going to be amazing.
But no, that must have been nice for Armour Best. He's a lovely guy.
Yeah, he's a dude.
And we had a discussion. I was telling you to go shopping and buy geek stuff. Did you buy any geek stuff?
I may or may not have some Han Solo themed
boxer shorts.
Boxer shorts, no. I may or may not have some Han Solo themed shoes.
Excellent.
Young or old Han Solo?
Actually, they're quite abstract, so it's more implied. Like, unless you were a nerd, you wouldn't know they were Solo shoes.
That's my favourite kind.
Yeah, it's quite subtle. It's got sort of a Corellian texturing, if you will.
Oh, good God.
But yeah, so I got that and a few other bits and bobs. I picked up some posters and whatnot, just nonsense that people were throwing at me. I did a Darth Vader VR thing while I was there.
Ooh.
Where I got to meet Darth Vader in VR. That wasn't intimidating at all.
Awesome.
But yeah, it was good.
Good.
It was a good trip.
Good.
Although I missed a valuable opportunity to reenact many scenes from films, like Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I walked past the fucking art gallery.
No.
It didn't occur to me to go in and take pictures of myself.
You fool.
Yeah. All I ever did, the closest I ever came, was I went and had a pizza under the name Abe Froman, the Sausage King of Chicago, and that was basically it.
Okay, 3 hours into the podcast, I think it's time for a question. And this one, unbelievably, appears to come from email. We have actually checked the inbox.
We have not.
Well, I don't know. It looks like an email to me. So
we don't have one.
So here it is. Hi, Pod. With Avengers Endgame upon us. Is it? God, I hadn't noticed. Many of us would have bought tickets for an Infinity War Endgame double bill with Endgame starting at midnight on the opening day. I have. Anyway, have any of you seen similar opening day midnight double bills? And if so, what advice do you have? What is the best way to ensure that you are awake when Endgame starts? And what future releases would you want a midnight screening for? That comes from Jason John.
Yeah, it's a tricky one because I want to be fresh for the first... If I'm really looking forward to a film, I don't want to see it at midnight, and I definitely don't want to see it after another really long film. So Endgame, as much as I want to see them both together, back to back on a big screen, and I'm sure I will, I don't want that to be my first experience of it.
Interesting, okay.
So I am going in fresh. But yeah, I don't know. Have you guys done that?
I did it last year, actually, for Infinity War. I didn't do a double bill.
You didn't watch all 20, 10 years of Marvel before?
No, I didn't do a double bill last year, although I will be this year. I will be watching Infinity War beforehand. I'm basically doing exactly this. But it won't be my first showing because I will have seen it the previous night at the press screening. So in terms of advice, I would say you've got to time your drinking really, really well. You want to stop drinking about an hour before the film is due to start so you can have that final pee before it starts. And then you only want to start drinking seriously again in the last hour of the film. You don't want to be sitting there, you know, busting for a wee.
You don't.
For the full last hour.
No, you don't. It's happened to all of us, right?
I
remember going to the multimedia screening of Poseidon, and obviously it's about a ship sinking, so they gave us loads of free water.
Mm-hmm.
Just big litre bottles
just like
of water.
Seawater.
So, regular water, fortunately. So I like downed all this water, and then I got trapped.
Oh.
And then it's a film about water, so you don't want to be needing a pee
while
watching Poseidon, or indeed ever watching Poseidon under any circumstances whatsoever, but especially not because there's just water torrents of it everywhere and you're like, that was a bad day.
King Kong, it was King Kong for me. I'd had some kind of grande frappe or whatever beforehand, and I was really loving that film. I really, really loved it. I didn't want to move, and we were in great seats, like middle of the front row of the balcony. It was great, wasn't it? But there was no way I was getting up and saying excuse me to 40 people to get out. So
that's a film that's not in a rush to end as well.
It's not
It's not in a rush to start.
I noticed.
It's like an hour on a boat, then an hour on the island, which is the best bit with the dinosaurs. And then New York goes on forever as well, so that's a tough one to need the loo
journey. I still love it though.
It's a great
film. But yeah, it was a painful last hour, let's just say.
I'm sure I have shared this on the podcast before, but my great urinary debacle with cinema was Star Trek Generations, where I was obviously drinking something and I needed a wee and I had to go out and have a wee and I missed the whole stellar cartography sequence. And frankly, no.
Oh.
This was a watershed moment for me, no pun intended. Since that day... Mm-hmm. I now don't consume any liquid in the run-up to any film. And if I have water with me in the cinema, I won't start drinking it until two-thirds of the way through.
That's it,
because under no circumstances will I ever, ever walk out of a film again.
Exactly. I mean, you can have some gums, some fruity gums with you. Mm-hmm. That'll keep the sort of, you know, the saliva going around in your mouth.
Yeah, just something like that.
Something
fine.
Like that.
But you've got to consider this.
Yeah.
You do have to plan.
You have to. And also, like, because often if you go into a press screening, like maybe the doors will open an hour before the film starts, you know, sitting there. You know, if you're going to go to the loo beforehand, which you should, you have to wait until realistically 10 minutes before it starts.
That's
especially
correct.
If it's the length of Endgame. Mm. So you're absolutely empty.
Yep.
When it begins. Is this too much information?
During Endgame, I've worked out a system. So every time the Avengers get an Infinity Stone back, I will have a sip of beverage. And when they enter the Quantum Realm, I will have some popcorn.
Okay, that seems fair.
Wow.
That's a good game. So, we may have strayed from the subject.
Yeah, what was the question? Well, it was about midnight screenings in general. Yeah. So are they, you know, do we do them?
No.
Which ones have we been to?
Under no circumstances ever should anyone go to a midnight screening. I take a very, very dim view of this whole like cinema as endurance test thing. Like in the same way, like, I can't be dealing with marathons either. It's like when you have a marathon screening, you ruin every single film in that marathon. Don't do it. Savor them. Watch them properly. Mm. Like if you watch Infinity War before Endgame and Endgame isn't starting until midnight, you're going into it tired, you've ruined the film. Well done.
Not necessarily, because if you've had a little disco nap after work before going to Infinity War, for example, you might be relatively fresh.
Perhaps. Who can nap after Infinity War? Come on.
No, before Infinity War.
Or before? Who can nap before Infinity War?
If you nap afterwards, you're going to miss Endgame, aren't you?
Well, no, I think there's a break in between. I think there is.
It's not a 7-hour break, though, is it?
No, that's true. That's true. I mean, you are a veteran of marathons.
I've done a bunch of marathons. Yeah. I've done a Bondathon, a 24 entire season in one go, which almost killed me, syncing up to the time in the show.
Wow.
But yeah, cinema wise, I agree with you, James. If they started at midday, like the Prince Charles Cinema does amazing marathons. Mm. They're doing an Arnie one, I think, this weekend. And I would love to go to some of them, but they start at midnight.
Hang on. You did a 24 marathon syncing up to the time of the show.
Yes.
It doesn't happen in real time because there are ad breaks. So how did that work? Well, did you pause it during the ad break?
I'm glad you asked. We factored in a 40-minute break per episode where we had coffee and basically rubbed caffeine into our eyeballs. But yeah, we factored that in. So we would wait until it was on the hour and then sync it back up again.
But the thing is, that can't be fun because it's just like at the end of it, you're told, like, so Game of Thrones, they're broadcasting, Sky are simulcasting it so you can watch it at 2 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. But Game of Thrones is amazing. I'm not watching it at 2 o'clock in the morning when I'm tired and just want to go to sleep. That's madness.
I will admit, so I went to see Infinity War midnight last year, and I will admit to getting really frustrated that they had exactly the same number of ads and trailers before the film, and that those didn't start until midnight. Like, those could have started at 11:43 or something.
I agree with you on that.
That would have been much, much better. So I had a bit of an issue with that. And by the end, because I had already seen it last year, I didn't stay for the end credits sting. Like,
oh,
that's
Helen,
how tired
you
I
cheat.
Was. I know. But having said that, I saw Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring at a midnight screening, day of release. Could not have been more excited. The entire cinema could not have been more excited. And it is one of the great viewing experiences of my life. So I feel like if you are sufficiently rested, it can be amazing.
Yeah, I've done the extended edition trilogy of Lord of the Rings at midnight all the way through the night. That was Return of the King gets quite...
That would get
you've got to be begging for death by the end of that, haven't you?
By the time you get to the 18 goodbyes at the end, you're like crawling on the floor out of there. And I've also done a time travel all-nighter. Both of these were at the BFI IMAX, and I don't recommend watching 4 time travel films starting at midnight. So it was Terminator 2, Back to the Future Part 2, Highlander, and then it finished with 12 Monkeys, which I think was not the best sequencing.
That's not the best route.
Because at like 5 in the morning, trying to figure out what's going on in 12 Monkeys, it's tough.
You don't need 5 in the morning, Gilliam.
That's tough. Wow. So there was advice in there somewhere, I'm pretty sure, for midnight screenings, but that is our advice.
Don't drink any beverage ever.
Yeah, just time your beverages. That's the main thing. Just be really, really careful of that, I would say.
Or bring a bucket.
And obviously, caffeine. That goes without saying. Coffee and whatever form you take it.
You've just given conflicting advice.
What?
Mind your beverages, but also caffeine.
But also, I mean, you could have caffeine, like, you could have chocolate-covered...
Pro Plus.
Cocoa beans.
You could. Chocolate-covered cocoa beans is what we suggest.
No, the other ones. Coffee beans. I remember words. I can do words. Okay, if you would like to have your question read out on the Empire Podcast, you can do so via Twitter. We are at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast, or we might not see it. Facebook, we are also at Empire Magazine. And email, we're podcast@empireonline.com. Okay, so just while we're on the subject of exciting screenings at exciting cinemas, we should let you know that during the month of May, we are teaming up with Picture House to run a sort of season of science fiction classics. It's all to celebrate our 30th birthday, which is, of course, this year. And we are doing a fantastic run of films. We have J.J. Abrams' Super 8 is kicking things off on the 4th of May. We're doing Aliens. We're doing First Man. We're doing Blade Runner 2049. We're doing Gravity in 3D. towards the end of the month. It's going to be absolutely amazing. And you can find out more at empireonline.com/picturehouse. It's also going to be a very affordable rate. It's £8. Or if you're a subscriber, you can get in for a fiver. Wow. You cannot say fairer than that. Brilliant, brilliant films. So look out for those. As I say, it's empireonline.com/picturehouse. So get after it. Okay, we're going to give our voices a rest for a minute because it's time, I think, for an interview break. Andrew Scott, for it is he, broke through into the mainstream consciousness as Sherlock's fiendish Moriarty, matching wits with Benedict Cumberbatch to deadly effect. Of late, he's been playing a sweary priest, in fact, the sweariest priest, I would say, since Father Jack, in Fleabag. And this week, he's back on the big screen playing what the Americans call a garbage man who starts investigating a missing person case in Steel Country. So we sent Chris along to find out more.
Delighted to be joined on the Emperor podcast by the star of Steel Country, Andrew Scott. How are you, sir?
I'm good, thanks, Chris. How are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad, not too bad. We were just having a little discussion beforehand about how you've detected a little hint of American in my accent.
Yes, indeed.
I don't know where you got that from. Where did you get that idea, pal? What about yourself over the years? Has your accent changed and waxed and waned?
Do you know what? I think it kind of hasn't.
Okay. Is that a conscious decision to hold on to your accent?
It's not. I don't know. It's a really weird thing with accents, isn't it? Like, because I've got friends who've lived in London Irish friends who've lived in London, and they, you know, they just sort of speak like that now. And you're like, you know, you're from Still Oregon in Dublin. What are you doing? But no, my accent seemed to have sort of, I think maybe because I change it so much.
Yeah.
Maybe less so than I used to. I used to sort of want to change my accent an awful lot in films and TV, and stage. But now I kind of much more into, if I can, not changing my accent.
Yeah.
I don't know what that is. I think maybe when you're a young actor, you sort of think, okay, I'll just get as far away from myself as possible. And that's what acting is.
Do you find it hard to go back to yourself in a way? When you're changing your accent, especially as a young actor, do you find that sometimes it's difficult to go back and remember kind of who you are and what your accent is?
Well, I think, yeah, I think you sort of, when you're younger, you feel like the more effort you're putting into into acting, you know, if I'm sort of completely transforming myself, that's what acting is. And I, you know, the older I get, the more I realize that's actually not what it is. What it is exploring as many different parts of yourself as you are. And I do kind of think that the better you know you are, the better you know yourself, the better you are as an actor. I really do think that's true. Before, I thought, because, I mean, of course, there's a lot of completely lunatics who are actors.
Yeah.
And that provides a certain gateway to a particular type of character. But I think if you want to kind of sweep the board of characters, I think the more you're sort of comfortable with yourself, and I do kind of think as well, the better the actor, usually the nicer they are. And also, sometimes success can be very good for actors, you know.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, some people who aren't difficult to work with or anything like that, there are the ones at the real top of their game are always pretty fantastic to work with too.
So whenever success visited you, how did you deal
with
that?
I've always been a nightmare.
Full tilt diva.
Just, yeah. Full tilt diva. Yeah, and that's
you
not going to change.
Demand water.
I did.
I mean, I may have asked you, would you like a water?
Yes, and I distinctly remember saying, room temperature water, and this is below room temperature.
I know. I'm sorry about that.
It's not as sorry as you will be.
You did slap me around a little bit off mic.
Yeah, so far, yeah, and that's just for starters. In an American accent.
Take that, you goddamn gee whiz willikers.
You little movie fuck.
But when you did become successful, though, I imagine, especially, say, for example, post Sherlock, flush of post Sherlock fame for you, where people are stopping you in the street.
Yeah.
What's that like for you? How do you deal with that without becoming a giant asshole?
Yeah, what's been sort of important for me is not to, because, you know, being Irish, being clubbable and friendly and all that kind of stuff is kind of part of the culture. It's definitely within me, and I like people. I like talking to people. So one of the big decisions I made was that I wasn't going to do social media, because actually, in a way, if you're doing Twitter and having to field lots of, you know, horrendous comments or crazy comments or even nice comments, or Instagram as it was then, or, you know, whatever it is, and then you're talking to people on the street and you're doing all the selfie thing as well, it could just like take over your life, and you start to sort of resent people. And I really don't want to start resenting people, because, you know, for the most part, I kind of like them.
Yeah.
And, for the most part. So I decided I wasn't going to do any of that kind of stuff. And so in a way, it sort of frees me up to sort of talk to people, and you get a sort of better vibe of what the person is like. And also, you're able to ask them questions back. You know, you're able to sort of go, so, you know, you have a proper... I think what was quite weird when you become more well-known or whatever is that you're asked an awful lot of questions, and you never get to ask questions yourself.
Ask me anything. I am an open book.
Why the fuck did you not get me room temperature water, you movie fuck?
A, it was all I had. B, I didn't realize you would get so violent so quickly.
Well, that was your big mistake.
that was pretty much it. That was pretty much it. And I apologize, and it won't happen again.
Okay.
Largely because I suspect I'm going to be in traction.
Yeah, because exactly. You don't have a future.
Well, this has been fun. Thanks for coming in, Andrew. This has been really, really great.
Fun for you.
Yeah. And Steel Country is available now.
Yeah, exactly. Plug the movie.
Plug the goddamn movie.
Before you go. Before you die.
We should talk about your work in Steel Country. It's a fantastic film, and you're great in it. And but it does go back to that idea that you were talking about at the beginning about accents and changing yourself.
And
because this character Donnie,
yeah, it's very different.
Very different.
Yeah, and I think I was definitely having been to a certain degree in villain territory. I sort of didn't want to play that note again. I just didn't want to do it. And so this is Donald is very, very vulnerable character. I would describe him as non sort of neurotypical. I've been kind of reluctant. People have said, is he, you know, has he got Asperger's or is he on the autistic scale? And I was kind of quite reluctant to diagnose the character, kind of simply because he's very neglected character. That's kind of the story of the character. The film is that there's a boy who's murdered, and they in a small town, and the investigative team just don't seem to care. They just completely neglect the case. And for some reason, I think this neglected man, who's a bin man, a very disenfranchised man in middle America, I kind of unconsciously, I think, takes this young dead boy's side, and in some ways sort of standing up for himself unconsciously by standing up for this boy and going, why aren't you doing that? Why aren't you doing that? And becoming slightly obsessive, because I think he's been neglected himself. And I think part of that neglect would be that people wouldn't have cared whether he was on the autistic scale, wouldn't have cared to diagnose him, or wouldn't have had the foresight to diagnose him himself. So I think, you know, there's a lot of people who are neurotypical who've got a lot of different ways of thinking.
Yeah.
And in exactly the same way, people who are non-neurotypical have very different ways of thinking. There's somebody with Asperger's syndrome, kind of a completely different way of thinking than another person with Asperger's syndrome, is the same way people who are neurotypical do. So it was kind of really, really interesting character in that sense, and a kind of new departure for me in my first American indie film and whatever.
How did they come your way?
Well, it's the producer of The King's Speech, Garrett Unwin, called me, and we went and had a meeting, and we had really nice initial conversation about it, and like with all independent films, it takes a while to get going, and then we went on our little adventure. We shot it in Griffin, Georgia, which is quite a bleak place in just outside Atlanta in Georgia, and that was very helpful because they literally had hardly any pavements. There was just McDonald's, and you know, it was bleak, guns and Trump signs everywhere, and I bought all my costumes in Walmart, and it was great. I pretended it's method that I just ate ice cream basically for breakfast for 6 weeks. Pretended I was
and lunch and dinner.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So it was a real experience seeing America, particularly around that time. It's just when Trump kind of came to power. And
yeah. So I was going to say, when did you shoot this?
It was about just after. It was about a year and a half ago now.
Okay.
Yeah.
And as an outsider, as an Irishman going into that situation, you know, how did the locals take to you in the production? You know, and what were your observations?
Well,
my
observations really were that I understood why they felt it felt so far away from liberal Washington. You know, I understood why people felt
angry.
And kind of very strangely apathetic. That's what it was. I mean, I met absolutely beautiful, gorgeous people, as you do, but there was a strange political sort of apathy about. I was asking them about voting for Trump, and just a lot of people just didn't vote. And I think that's the real sinister thing, which sort of the film touches on, which is, you know, just a sort of, what are you doing? Come on, you can't just not, it's the lack of questioning, which is sort of frightening, you know. But yeah, I had a good time, but I was glad it wasn't for too long, you know.
Mm. And there's something about, there's a restlessness inside Donnie as he begins to investigate this crime that I think is very, very interesting. And there's this idea that was explored. I don't know whether you saw Bart Layton's American Animals, but this...
I haven't seen American Animals.
Oh, my God, it's so good. You should check it out. It's incredible.
That's the one that young Irish actor Barry Keoghan is in, right?
Barry Keoghan, indeed.
He's such a star.
Oh, my God, he's so good. Mm, and the film is terrific. But it's one of those films that kind of examines... not the restlessness of young people growing up in America, but the fact that they don't feel that there's anything to their lives. And so sometimes they maybe invent a purpose for themselves.
Yeah, right.
Because they're directionless, because there's nothing at the end of the end of it all. And Donnie, I feel a little bit, there's maybe a little bit of
really
that
true.
In Donnie.
Yeah, he's got no father figure. His father has died. He's been neglected and kind of borderline abused. He's got very few people to love. So... I don't think he has the kind of self-confidence or the self-worth to stand up for himself.
Mm.
But when this little boy is just disappears and then they go, yeah, well, this is what happened, and then they just move on. I think it's definitely accidental. I don't think he's even that he becomes obsessed. And then, like those things, you find out things more and it just sort of just takes over his life. And I think that's what happens if you suppress people in that way. They rise up in very, very sinister ways.
Mm.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You obviously, you divide your time obviously between the big screen, the small screen, and the stage as well.
Yeah.
Is there a grand plan in place?
No.
Okay.
No, there absolutely isn't.
Okay, that's good to know.
In a word. No, there isn't a grand plan, apart from doing the thing that you just haven't done. You know what I mean? Like I used to act when I was a kid. Not like professionally, but I've always maintained that to maintain a playfulness about acting, to play one particular type of thing, has never been of too much interest to me. And in fact, when it seems to be going down that road, I always kind of want to veer off somewhere else, you know.
Yeah.
And I suppose maybe that's why I like moving between genres and genres within genres. Last year we were doing, or the year before, we did some Shakespeare and playing Hamlet, and then you know, we're going to do a bit more stage this year, but comedy, but a Noel Coward, and exactly the same way. I love the idea of working on a big budget films. I think it's really fun. But then the independent films, and then TV is such a golden age for television at the moment. And
so there's no grand plan in place. But how do you decide what comes next for you? So if you say, for example, you know, you go Hamlet, there's Fleabag as well.
Yeah.
Obviously, then you're saying Noel Coward as well.
Yeah.
So do you decide, okay, I want to do a comedy, and then put the feelers out there, or does something come your way?
I think that's it. I think I kind of go, yeah, I'd like to definitely go down. I've always wanted to play. I've always found romantic comedy very appealing, but for some reason. That it sort of eluded me a little bit, and I was always kind of saying that's something that's part. There's a lot of things that aren't within my remit, but that is. So when Fleabag came about, for example, I was really excited because chiefly the thing that attracts me has always been, I think when I was quite young, I used to work at the Abbey Theatre in Dublin when I was about 19 and 20, and I got addicted to good writing.
Yeah.
And I'm very grateful for the fact that I did sort of small Irish independent films. I always had films and TV going on, you know, right from the get-go. But I got kind of addicted to really good writing. So that's what I would definitely look for. You go, someone who's got a bit of an autograph. That's a completely unique... There's something about that that's just unique. So romantic comedy coupled with somebody like Phoebe, who has got such a unique voice, who I worked with 10 years ago in the theatre and knew of her spirit. Obviously, I'd seen Fleabag, the first series. Mm. That just seemed like an amazing opportunity, and I signed on to do that. Phoebe and I had a big conversation about it last summer, and I said yes to it before I'd even read any scripts. Yeah, because you go with a vibe, don't you? You go with a vibe, and then the scripts turn out to be kind of okay.
Passable. Barely passable.
Yeah. But I mean, if somebody like Phoebe, who's able to write about a fox breaking into a toilet of a train and then break your heart and then talk about how your hair looks amazing on the day of your mother's funeral, I mean, that's just all those things contained in a 25-minute episode. I mean, that's...
Yeah, she's incredible.
It's totally unique. And I'm very grateful that she saw that part of me in me, because, you know, it was definitely something that kind of needed and wanted to be expressed.
Yeah, because you mentioned there you didn't want to be kind of pigeonholed into the villain thing.
Yeah.
The last time we spoke was for Empire magazine and was for Spectre.
Yeah.
And was there even at the time, I mean, it's a Bond film, so I guess, you know, you don't say no to a Bond film, but were you wary of that role as well, given, I think we can spoil Spectre 3 years down the line.
Yeah, absolutely.
That there's a bad guy role as well.
Yeah, I was, if I'm honest. You go into that and it's incredibly exciting thing to be involved in. And I love Sam. Sam and Mendes had directed me in the theatre. And there were my pals around. Ben Whishaw was a great pal of mine. And lots of, you know, Daniel had done lots of theatre. And it felt Ray Fiennes and Rory Kinnear and all these amazing people. But yeah, to a certain extent, I was a little wary of, well, I suppose I didn't feel that for me it was a great stretch at the time. But sometimes, you know, it's okay to not stretch yourself as an actor, and you know, you sort of try your best, and it was a wonderful experience, and you know, it afforded me things that allowed me to do other things, and you know, I try with those things not to think on them too deeply. I would say that most of my joyful sort of things that I'll remember on my deathbed, if I remember anything, will be the more independent stuff, you know. But I love the idea of, I don't believe in high art and low art and stuff. I love when there's a big success, box office wise, for things that are intelligent, because I don't think those things have to be mutually exclusive. I really don't.
Absolutely.
And that's what's happening in TV now. I mean, that's really, TV is leading it. We have something like Fleabag, or, you know, really intelligent stuff that people are really, really watching.
Absolutely.
You
know? Something like Derry Girls. And,
yeah, you know, Derry Girls. What about Derry Girls? Amazing.
Bit of a golden age at the moment.
Yeah.
But speaking of, you know, intelligent, big budget filmmaking.
Yeah.
You're about to work with Mr. Mendes again?
Yes, I am. Yeah, we're doing a film called 1917, which is set in World War One. And without giving the game away too much, it's a very personal story to Sam.
Mm-hmm.
And the scale of it is pretty enormous. And
Can you say anything about who you play?
I play a member of the army.
I've heard things about what Sam may be attempting in this movie.
Well, it's very, very stylistically exciting.
We'll leave it there for the time being.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it'll be really unique. And it's got all these people. Obviously, Benedict is in it, which is and Colin Firth, and, you know, mate Mark Strong and Richard.
When do you start in that?
I've started already.
You started?
Yeah.
Do they know you're here?
Huh?
Do they know you're here?
They are here. They're filming.
It's time travel.
Yeah, exactly.
It's time travel as well.
Yeah, exactly.
There you go. I knew I'd get out of you eventually.
Exactly. Right, yeah.
And have you brought any of your Private Ryan experience to bear on this?
Do you know what? It's so weird that I've been in so many. I think I told you before they used to. No, it was on Band of Brothers. I was in Band of Brothers.
Yes.
And they used to call me the Reluctant Soldier. There he is, there's a reluctant soldier. Because I was like, oh, God, this is so tedious. All that stuff. But yeah, I definitely am wearing a slightly different shade of green.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I can tell you that. It's a little bit more mossy.
Uh-huh.
I've been in a few war things now. It's kind of funny. Because I'm a lover, not a fighter.
Let's throw that back out at the world. Andrew Scott wants to do a romantic comedy.
Yeah, absolutely.
On the big screen. I can see you in a remake of While You Were Sleeping. You in the Sandra Bullock role.
Absolutely.
Let's make this happen.
I'll play Sandy's part any day of the week. Any day of the week. Yeah.
Fantastic. But Andrew Scott, it's been a pleasure. Thanks,
absolute
man.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks
Thank
so
you.
Much, Chris.
Cheers. I apologize again for the water.
All right, so time for some movie news. We've mentioned Star Wars already, but let's talk about some of the news that have emerged this week about Knights of the Old Republic, which even I, not having played the game, think is quite an intriguing proposition. But James, as our resident expert, please tell us more.
What's really funny is, and I was literally just reading the story on the site, we've quoted MTV who ran this story, and I realised I was standing next to MTV when Kathy Kennedy had this conversation with them, so I remember it word for word. They essentially said, you know what, you can do something in Knights of the Old Republic, and she said, we talk about it all the time, we are currently putting together something to look at. So she's not said something's going into production.
Okay.
She said they're kicking around an idea which they're then going to look at, so it's one of the possibilities. However, as you say, yes, it's a very exciting sort of period that hasn't really been explored outside that game and its sequel, and and you know, I guess in the comics and novels and whatnot. She mentioned they're exploring all sorts of areas. We don't know yet what Rian Johnson's trilogy is going to be. We don't know what David Benioff and Dan Weiss's trilogy is going to be. So there's a lot of interesting stuff out there. Mm. But yeah, I'm glad they're looking at this. I think, to be honest, they're looking at everything. But yeah, this is something the fans definitely want.
And this is something that we've talked about before as being maybe a bit of a more fertile ground than something like Solo. Because, you know, I've been very on record as saying I don't need to know where Han Solo specifically came from. I love him as he is. But I am interested in what happened 3,000 years ago or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Because it gives you more space to work with. It's still connected. It's still in the same universe.
Yeah.
But it's not, you know, we're not sitting there the whole time going, oh, we know what's going to happen to him. Like,
yeah,
it's
a very different sort of playground to sort of mess around in. So, yeah, I'd be very interested in seeing this. And I think that it will help them deal with one of the biggest problems, which is how do you differentiate between Star Wars things, because if you deviate too far from it, it's not Star Wars anymore. Mm-hmm. So you're in a slightly difficult area there. Whereas this is Star Wars, but also a very different Star Wars. So same races, it's still got lightsabers, it's still got all sorts of key elements, but also different. You're also not tied into all of this, only two there are, a master and an apprentice, and all that, you know, latter-day Jedi stuff that George introduced. This has a sort of different underpinning mythology.
Yes.
So, I'm all for Old Republic Knights.
Mm. Is that what we're... Is that what we're calling it?
No, it's Knights of the Old Republic.
Thank you. It was really distressing me there for a minute. All right, let's talk about some trailers, because we've had a couple of interesting trailers this week. But should we start with the ridiculous one? Should we start with Hobbs and Shaw?
Ridiculous. Come on, Helen.
Sorry.
It was gritty and realistic and maybe about 3 minutes too long. But yeah, what did you think of it?
I would say it's a really long trailer to be that full of action beats. I feel like we maybe could have done with a few less, if anything.
It was slightly exhausting.
Mm.
But yeah, they showcased a lot of different action scenes in our new issue coming up. I don't think it's a spoiler to say we have a bit of an article on a scene near the end of the film where they're on an island and you meet Hobbs, Dwayne Johnson's extended family, including his parents, and they have a large sort of Samoan, quite a sweaty wrestle, basically.
Okay.
They haven't got weapons, so they have to just hit each other with fists. So you get a bit of that in the trailer, but you also get like a sort of scene in a prison or a lab, the bit where they're just punching. There's a lot of punching in this
trailer. There's a lot of punching. There's a supreme amount of punching.
And then towards the end of the trailer, it just goes batshit crazy and has them driving some kind of monster truck while bringing a helicopter. It just goes full Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. I thought it was a bit too long. Some of the one-liners didn't quite work. The bit where Jason Statham is slamming the guy's head into the ID pad, I thought it should have opened it on the third go. But
I do too. That was exact. I was expecting that to happen.
Needed a punchline.
Yeah. Punch.
Punch, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Headbutt line.
But, I mean, you know, it does look every bit as ridiculous as I hoped this film would be. So in that respect, it certainly seems to be delivering.
And Idris Elba describes himself as Black Superman.
And then The Rock agrees with him.
The Rock agrees and repeats it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so, James, you were less enthusiastic.
You could say that. I did not enjoy it. It has the whiff of comedy about it, and you know how I feel about that kind of thing. Yeah, it feels to me like, and this is clearly an intentional choice, that like The Fast and Furious, which started out as a film series, it took itself very seriously, like it was very much an action thriller, and then the comedy and the absurdity has dialed up with each installment, but it is still at its heart an action film that is comedic, whereas this is a comedy. Like, certainly from the trailer, it seems like a comedy with action rather than an action film with comedy. And for me, that's unacceptable.
I agree with you in a way that, yeah, the Fast and Furious films are kind of at their best when you're not sure whether they're trying to be funny or not.
Exactly that.
You know, when Vin Diesel's, you know, living life half a quarter of a mile at a time and stuff, you kind of suspect he's not joking, but it's hilarious.
Well, you get the impression often from that everyone is in on the joke except Vin Diesel. But I think on this one, they're everyone. Like, it's clearly a joke. You know, they're all in on it. They're having fun with it. And that's fine, but it courts absurdity too overtly for me. Like, I need a degree of at least the pretense of subtlety.
Plausibly deniable.
Exactly. I love it. Absurdity. I think it's at its best where it's clearly absurd and it's clearly ridiculous and it's hilarious. But they can turn to camera at any point and say, no, we're making a serious film here, and sell that. Do you know what I mean? They can sell that, and you can't.
I think there's definitely a space for this film, though, because, I mean, action films are getting more and more kind of serious and grim, and the mythology, even something like John Wick, which is ridiculous, is now getting taking itself quite seriously.
Oh, but I love the mythology. Those films.
John Wick is brilliant, but there's definitely room for just a total cheesy, full-on popcorn ridiculous, overblown action movies.
Yeah.
Right. I'm down for it. It's the Tango and Cash of this summer. Come on.
It may literally be that, yeah.
Yeah. All right, fair enough. Otherwise, in trailer news this week, we had a Dark Phoenix trailer that amps up the sort of Dark Phoenix threat quite a lot. Anybody, you know, more swayed on this one either way? Still Christmas Eve?
Yeah. I'm cautiously optimistic about this film. I don't think it's going to be a bad film. I think it's going to be infinitely better than Apocalypse, but yeah, that's a really low bar to clear.
So low. But
there's a bittersweet tang to this, because this is the last of these X-Men films, so that makes me a little bit sad. I'm very intrigued. Like, I'm looking forward to it.
The thing I did think about Dark Phoenix is it felt like Jennifer Lawrence was embracing the sweet kiss of being killed off in this franchise. Like, you know, she was, there was a sense of weird relief all around there.
Well, also, if you listen really carefully and turn down the music track, you can hear her going, I'm free, free!
Come on, kill me, kill me.
Kill me, do it now. Yeah, kill me.
Yeah.
Speaking of people who are hard to kill, this is a terrible segue. Let's talk about Master Chief. I'm aware of Halo. I'm aware it's a thing. The physics of the Halo world kind of annoyed me because it seemed...
Do you mean John 117?
Yes.
For that is his real name?
Yes. He's a clone?
He's a Spartan super soldier.
Yes. Okay. That sounds familiar.
Yeah.
I've watched people...
It's a ring world, isn't it? You're talking about the physics of it. It's a ring world, isn't it?
It is, yeah. But the sun seemed to be in the wrong place for me, so I was
yeah,
upset
so
by that.
It's an odd one because the Halo in this isn't around a sun. Mm. Like, it's just in space.
Well, there's two kinds in the Ian M. Banks books. There's the orbital and the other one. And they're both ring worlds, but they work in different ways. So maybe it's the other one. Mm. Anyway, but that always kind of annoyed me about Halo. But it's a ring world, and there's this dude who's a Spartan, and he's fighting people?
I don't know the plot of this. So this is a TV show, and I don't know quite what story it's going to take. This has this game series and the surrounding fiction has quite a deep mythology. There is a period in the mythology where they land on a Halo.
Yes.
So this thing, they crash land on it while being chased by an alien race, another alien race, not the people who built the Halo. Although the best story happens just before that, which is the fall of Reach. Maybe that will be
goodness.
In the series.
Okay,
we can all hope that it is. But yeah, but the thrust of this is that Pablo Schreiber will be the Master Chief, aka John 117. Yeah.
Right, and he's the guy from... He was the...
Pawntash from Orange is the New Black.
Okay, or I was going to say he's the giant leprechaun in American
Mad
Gods.
Sweeney, yes, yeah. He's that too.
So I'm a Sweeney, so I approve of his casting.
You're an O'Hara, okay. What are you talking about?
I'm also a Sweeney. My mum's a Sweeney.
And who is kind of showrunning this? Because, you know, there was a film version that almost got off the ground that Neil Blomkamp was going to direct and Peter Jackson was producing.
Yeah.
And so it's got a really tortured kind of history, Halo, in terms of getting to the screen. So who's looking after it now?
It is now Kyle Killen and Stephen King.
Kyle Killam.
Kyle Killen.
Killam all.
Yes.
Okay.
We've also got an Australian newcomer called Yeren Ha, who's a newly created character in this universe called Quan Ah. But we don't know much about how that fits into the story, but he's described as a shrewd, audacious 16-year-old from the outer colonies who meets the Master Chief at a fateful time for them both.
There you go.
How exciting. Okay. Staying on a kind of TV show tip, Mike Myers is coming to Netflix.
Really?
Hopefully not for some kind of hellish love guru spin-off, but yeah, we don't know much. We know that he will be playing multiple characters. There's a big shock there. Yeah. I mean, I'm excited to see Mike Myers come back. I kind of was waiting for them to announce Austin Powers 4. That seemed like something that's definitely going to happen at some point, but yeah, why not?
I hope he plays the Scottish father from So I Married an Axe Murderer.
Heath Dune!
What if he comes back as some kind of all his characters from different films, and now it's like some kind of weird Spider-Verse? Oh, it's into
He'll
the Myerverse.
He'll be tying himself to sleep tonight on his huge pillow.
Oh my God.
Sorry.
Okay.
I apologise on behalf of all our Scottish listeners.
Yeah, thank you for that, because really. The Cannes Film Festival opened up its lineup today.
Oui, oui.
Oh, it's Très Français. Très bien. Très bien.
I apologise on behalf of this podcast to all our French listeners.
Should we just apologise to the world?
Yeah, we probably should. Now, they have interestingly said that this is not necessarily the complete lineup yet. They have gone so far as to say, it suggests essentially that there's some more films coming, which are expected, for example, to include Greta Gerwig's Little Women and or Quentin Tarantino's
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So it's an interesting time. They have managed four films by women in competition, which is, believe it or not, a record-equaling number. So I guess that's good. Mm. There's 13 female directors among the 50 or so announced across all of the selections, but four in competition. But yeah, I mean, the usual kind of suspects are there. Xavier Dolan is back. Terrence Malick's latest will be there. I think that's the longest film in competition,
yep,
by about an hour. Bong Joon-ho is there as well. Pedro Almodóvar. So, you know, it kind of looks like Cannes pretty much being Cannes. The most exciting one for me is Jim Jarmusch and The Dead Don't Die.
That's the opening film, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, it's the kind of indie zombie film with Bill Murray in it. What is that film going to be?
It's a Jarmusch-y.
It is a Jarmusch-y.
Yeah.
Basically, I'm just super on board with Jim Jarmusch in general and with pretty much every cast member in general. So I mean, feel like I'm
this
there.
This is Bill Murray's second zombie film, which is kind of bizarre. But yeah, no, I'm excited for that one. So we shall see. Other stuff. John Cena.
Mm-hmm.
Suicide Squad 2. Come on, guys. We don't know who he's playing yet, but we know that John Cena will play some kind of role.
Presumably someone whose power is being invisible. Because you can't see him.
Yeah, okay. This is a wrestling thing, isn't it? I never remember this.
I know. I don't.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
Did you see that Dave Bautista has now officially retired from wrestling? Like he lost to Triple H at WrestleMania, and that was his swan song. That was his final match. He's now done. He has left sports entertainment forever. He's hung up his little pant things.
It's a tragedy for us all.
Done.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a big thing because he's been wrestling for a long time, and you know it's a big deal for him to step out of the ring. I mean,
his film career seems to be going pretty well.
Yeah, yeah. I think I'm not saying he's on the breadline now. I think he's doing very, very well for himself.
Yeah.
Nope.
Yeah. But anyway. Yeah, end of an era. I suppose you're right. That's absolutely right.
So going back to John Cena and actual movie news.
Sure.
Yeah. No. I mean, look, the guy managed to star in a good Transformers film, which we didn't know that was possible to be a thing. So. You know, we didn't really like the first Suicide Squad.
No.
It seems like this one's shaping up. Yeah. Idris Elba, John Cena, like, the cast is getting pretty good.
Mm.
$6 billion man, staying in the action thing.
Well, actually, there's a Bumblebee kind of relationship there.
Knight.
So Travis Knight directed that and is now signed up to direct, it looks like, the $6 billion man, which will be Mark Wahlberg as the former astronaut who gets an upgrade.
Yeah, adjusted for inflation.
Yeah, I know. It is. I love that it's been adjusted for inflation. $6 million.
Six
really?
Million will get you like a bionic finger these days.
I mean, that's a lot, though. That's what Forbes estimated the cost of Tony Stark's entire suit at, about $7 billion each. So, you know, that's a lot of money.
They should have gone for trillion. Maybe that's the sequel.
Maybe that will be the same.
But this is like Mark Wahlberg kind of doing a superhero film without doing a superhero film, isn't it? Because he kind of gets upgraded vision and speed and power and all kinds of stuff.
Have you seen that Wahlburgers is opening in Covent Garden?
Oh my goodness.
Amazing.
I interviewed Mark Wahlberg and Peter Berg together last year, and I suggested that he call one of his things on the menu a Peter Burger. Peter Burger.
Did he hit
it didn't
you,
really
or?
Work. After I explained it, he said it was really funny and that he was gonna make some calls. Uh-huh. So if that happens, then that was squarely me.
Okay, all the best jokes have to be explained, I think.
It was excruciating.
So very quick couple just to finish. It looks like we talked a couple of weeks ago about Michael B. Jordan signing on for Methuselah as the very long-lived dude who's been around for centuries. It now looks like Spider-Man's John Watts will be potentially directing that film, which is good news. And then also there was a little bit of casting from Marvel's The Eternals. So Ma Dong-seok from Train to Busan, and apologies to all our Korean listeners for my pronunciation of his name, he is apparently lined up for The Eternals, which would be great because he's so good in Train to Busan, which if you haven't seen it, just stop everything and go and watch it. It's an incredible film. So yeah, that's a good piece of casting, I think. It's exciting to see him jump to American films.
One last thing. Tomb Raider 2.
Yeah.
It's going to be written by Amy Jump, which is really exciting and
it
amazing.
Is.
She's Ben Wheatley's kind of creative partner. She wrote Free Fire and High Rise with him, and this is super exciting.
It is, because, I mean, Tomb Raider, I thought the casting was fine. I think Alicia Vikander is a really good fit for the role. I just felt the script needed another pass, and I feel like Amy Jump is the person to get it to a stage of not needing passes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's exciting. Also, the rumours this week that Phoebe Waller-Bridge is polishing up the Bond script.
That's right.
Which is intriguing.
Yes, it is. I mean, she could write absolutely anything and I'd be thrilled to bits. I'd be happier if she was Bond, quite frankly. But
that would be amazing.
She's great, great writer. Obviously, it's notoriously, shall we say, not female-friendly franchise. So maybe they're trying to address that. And if so, how does that even work, given that the whole concept of it is, you know, he's a misogynistic dinosaur, a relic of the Cold War. And I know that because Judi Dench said so, and she wouldn't lie to me.
Judi Dench would never lie to any of us. It is written, it is certain. it is set. Also, just to finish off, the In the Heights cast, you know I've been following this. It has been finalised. Stephanie Beatrice from Brooklyn Nine-Nine has joined this week. Dasha Polenko from Orange is the New Black. Daphne Rubin and Vega. They have confirmed Jimmy Smits. It is a huge, huge lineup. I think it's really, really exciting, and it's shaping up very, very well. John M. Chu, of course, from Crazy Rich Asians, is set to direct, and it's due in theatres next year, so they should be filming really any day now.
Ooh. You could say that cast is hitting new heights.
You could, except they've been around for a while, those heights.
That's true. Cancel that.
So that is movie news. We are finishing up. Shall we have another interview, do you think? I think we should. So Irish director Neil Jordan is one of the most versatile talents around, a very independent voice who can tackle anything from interviews with vampires to biopics of Irish heroes to kind of twisted fairy tales like The Company of Wolves or Ondine. This week he brings us a twisty, unusual psychological drama in Greta, which stars Isabel Huppert and Chloe Grace Moretz in a sort of generation-spanning friendship. Or is it? We sent Chris along to meet him and they had a great time, but full disclosure, before you go any further, this interview gets spoilerific, all right? It was just the way the conversation went. It was a really interesting conversation, so they just kept going. So if you haven't seen Greta yet, skip it and come back when you have. Otherwise, listen, enjoy, because Jordan's a really good interview and he talks a lot in depth about the film, but just as I say, beware spoilers. But here is Neil Jordan.
Delighted to be joined on the Emperor podcast by the director of Greta and the co-writer, of course, Neil Jordan. How are you?
How are you? I'm good, yeah.
I'm good, good. Yeah, can't complain. This is your return to feature films after 7 years away. I presume that's a gap you didn't intend to happen.
No, it's not that long. Come on, I mean, you know.
It's not Kubrickian, Neil, but it's fairly lengthy.
I wrote a novel in between times.
Okay.
I really did. And I walked off a television series. All of which takes time, okay?
Walking off a TV show, that's not an easy thing.
No, no, no.
That's something you can do overnight.
No, no. But I did write a novel called Carnivalesque, yeah. Uh-huh. And the real reason I've been out so long is I was hit by a bus and I shattered my kneecap. So I couldn't walk for a year and a half, you know.
Blimey.
Yeah.
Wow, okay. Yeah. What happened there?
So I had a sports accident. I severed my ACL. I was crossing the street in Dublin after the surgery and... Uh-huh. You know, I had an encounter with a large vehicle.
Jesus.
Basically, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So it was a bit, you know, I literally couldn't get out of bed for 6 months, you know. I was in, you know, plastered up and all that shit, you know.
Did you have the whole life flashes before your eyes, all that sort of stuff, or was it not quite that bad?
No, it wasn't that bad. No. I mean, it was pretty, you know, it was not good not being able to move. Wasn't good, you know.
But,
and you know, as a film director, it's like you're basically unemployable if you can't move, you know.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Yeah. I don't know, Neil. I've been to a few video villages now. You can get yourself a big chair, one of those big orthopedic beds.
I know.
A lot of directors direct through loudspeaker these days. I've seen that happen as well.
I know.
But I imagine that's not your style. No. So that period of enforced convalescence, did that give you a chance in a way to focus on other projects, get the novel done, and think about various films? And at some point, Greta, I imagine, emerged. For you.
Yeah, well, I was sent it, you know, basically, and it was a thriller, stalker thriller that was sent to me by my agent, and I read it, and I thought it was really concise, far simpler than I ever would have allowed myself to be, you know, and it had this marvelous hook about this handbag, and it was about between two women. I just thought, that's really interesting, I'd like to get involved, I'd like to do something with that, you know. Mm. Really.
So when you say it's far simpler than you would have allowed yourself to be, do you mean as a writer when you sit down to write something?
I just tend to be complicated, you know?
Yeah.
And there was a very simple idea in this, you know, she finds a handbag. Handbag means a lot of things. You know, she finds somebody else's life in there, you know, and she begins to pursue this life, or, you know, she returns it. And there's an encounter that leads to, the encounter could lead to, you know, could have led to a lifelong friendship. In this case, it leads to kind of chaos. And she ends up in a box, you know. I just thought it was terribly simple, and it was like there was the idea of a nightmarish fairy tale to it. And I basically said, if I can cast this right, I'll do it. And when Isabel said she wanted to play it, I began to rewrite the script, you know. So this second half of it really kind of becomes as complicated as more like as complicated as I am, kind of thing, you know.
But let's talk through that process then. So you get the script, you like the script, and you have a co-writing credit on the script. Was that the intent from the off? You get this thing.
Normally as a director, if you rewrite a script, it's very hard to get a credit, you know.
So what happened?
I don't know, really. I think the writer, in the end, he wanted to give me one, you know. He must have liked what I did.
Mm-hmm. And then at the point where you're starting to write the script, do you complicate things yourself? Is that
your process? No, I construct things around the character, really. I basically thought that in the original script, she was older. She was directly a Hungarian immigrant from the 50s.
You know, this is Greta herself.
Yeah. And she was the kind of woman you see like stopped at a traffic light, weighed down by shopping bags that you want to say,
of course,
can I help you and help you across the road kind of business, you know, that kind of thing. When Isabel got interested in it, I said, okay, I'm going to restructure this part and to rewrite the part entirely, you know. So I made her, gave her this French veneer, you know, gave her the piano to play, made her younger, gave her more style. And
because it has to be someone you think that
seduces
and beguiles.
Yeah, but you can be seduced by helplessness as well, you know. In the initial script, she was, you know, Frances was kind of seduced by the inability of this person to face the city and all that sort of stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. But I just changed the character, really, you know, and made, I suppose, the kind of fairy tale resonances of it much more important, you know. She didn't play the piano in the original screenplay. There wasn't that painted Hungarian box, you know. Mm-hmm. There wasn't, she didn't get her finger chopped off. There was a lot of things that weren't there, you know.
Mm. And the fairy tales, I mean, that goes all the way back to the beginning of your career.
Well, it's not that much, really. It's more the psychological drive of a situation like that. If you take a situation where, okay, a young woman is being pursued by this older woman to whom she promised friendship, you know, I mean, it's kind of the situation of that is dying to get into the areas of kind of nightmarish confinement of a fairy tale, you know. To me, it seems that's where this story wants to go, you know. And I kind of asked the story where it wants to go. and maybe that's my corny way of saying I rewrite it, you know, to where I want it to go. But I do kind of ask it. I kind of want to know, where does this material want to head, you know what I mean? And it was interesting exploring it, really, because it was, I mean, there's two things that intrigued me about the script. One was it was so simple, yeah. The other was that it was between two women, yeah? So it wasn't Anthony Hopkins, or it wasn't Anthony Perkins, or it wasn't Nicolas Cage, or whoever, you know? Or it wasn't Terrence Stamp, actually, in The Collector. Do you remember The Collector?
I do remember The Collector.
Yeah. It wasn't a male, it was a female. The other thing was that the obsession was not a sexual one, and I thought that was really intriguing. It was kind of about motherhood, you know? And I began to think, well, maybe motherhood is the greatest pathology known to all of us, you know, the secret one that's never exposed itself, you know. And I thought that was really cool, you know.
Was that always there from the beginning, in terms of Frances has lost her mother at the beginning?
Yeah, that was always there.
She logs in, and she, one of the reasons, she locks into Greta.
Yeah, she locks in.
And Greta locks into her.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
And I thought it was really intriguing, and I thought, okay, I'm going to develop these. So once Greta has captured her and stuck her in that childhood box, which is, you know, you can imagine a baby playing around in that box, can't you, even if the lid wasn't closed, you know?
Yeah.
And she wants to reduce her to a child. And having reduced her to a child, she wants to remake her into the kind of a daughter that would, you know, have the refinement and obey the rules of etiquette that she herself obeys. You know, I thought that's much more interesting than if she wanted a sexual partner.
Yeah. I mean, as the film begins to develop, and as that relationship begins to develop, I detected a slight note that there was maybe at the beginning a sexual interest from Greta towards Frances. But as that goes
where
on...
Where does sexual interest begin and end? You know what I mean? Yeah. I mean, you know, it can be bubbling underneath a paternalistic relationship or a maternalistic relationship or a master-slave relationship or anything. But the fact that it wasn't overtly sexual, which I thought was really kind of refreshing. I'm a bit tired of sex. Maybe it's my age, you know? No, but do you understand what I mean? It's like I'm a bit tired of
being
the outre and daring, with kind of vaginal issues and dick issues or whatever, you know. It's like, come on, you know, I've been there. You know, I think motherhood is a far more interesting pathology myself, you know.
It's a fascinating treatment of the subject that it is a female-on-female stalker in this movie. Given the times we're in at the moment, given, you know, we're still in the... in the throes of Me Too and Time's Up. Was that something that you discussed with Isabel and Chloe on set? Was that something that attracted them to it? Was that something that attracted that you to it as well?
I think it attracted everybody to it, that it was a relationship between women, you know. But I mean, I'm not telling a story of feminist empowerment here at all. It's just the fact that it was, the kind of men were irrelevant, was intriguing and refreshing, really, you know. And but I don't think there is that a Me Too aspect of this, really.
I don't think there is necessarily either, but it's just it's fascinating that there's a woman in this movie who is overtly evil, is obviously a very strong word, but she's very, very clearly the villain.
Evil, yeah, but the villain, there's great villainesses in fairy tales, isn't there? You know, I mean... Snow White, Hansel and Gretel.
People that kept me awake at night when I was growing up.
Yeah, that's
for sure.
Yeah.
And Isabel, so you're reading this script initially, and it is this Hungarian woman, this with, you know, potentially with a shopping trolley full of debris and detritus. Isabel Huppert doesn't necessarily leap off the page from that description you gave me.
She was never a bag lady. No.
Okay.
She was somebody who lived in a really nice apartment in Brooklyn.
Oh, she always had that. Okay.
Oh, she always had that, but she was exhausted by life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't mean she was a bag lady at all, but she was just somebody who was older, more obviously maternal, you know, that kind of thing. Isabel was interested in the potential to explore the demonic aspect of a character, really, without excuses, you know? I mean, for me to make this movie, I need three really good actors, you know? And, you know, when Chloe, Isabel, and Micah said they wanted to do it, I was in, really. She did research a lot of, what is that case? The Fritzl case?
Oh, yeah,
Joseph
Fritzl.
She researched that. And a lot of these cases of abduction. And the interesting thing is they're all male, they're all men. Except for Frederick West. He had a female accomplice, didn't he?
Yeah, Rose.
And who's the lady, the Moore's murderers?
Mara Hindley,
yeah. Who's regarded as the far more terrifying figure than Ian. Was it Ian, her partner, was it?
Ian Brady, yeah. I feel like I'm being tested on serial killers here,
what's
Neil.
That?
I feel like I'm being tested on serial killers.
I don't know much about them. I'm not an expert at all, but it's like, so I'm sorry.
Is it discomforting that I know too? I knew these names immediately. What does it say about me?
Well, I knew somebody who actually slept in what's the name again? Frederick West's house.
Really?
Yeah, because it was like, where? It was somewhere in Somerset or Yorkshire?
Somewhere around there, yeah.
Yeah. Traveling around, you know, you go to a pub, you begin to smoke dope, you meet some people, you haven't got anywhere to stay. Somebody says, oh, come and stay. And I know a crash pad, you know, that kind of thing. Seriously.
Wow.
And he spent the night there, lying on the floor with Frederick and Rosemary West's house, with some other people, I think, you know, which is kind of scary, isn't it?
Wow. My God.
But it's interesting, the thought that you are so close to kind of pathology, you know, particularly in a city, you know, behind any door there could be not a ghost but a human monster, you know. And another thing that appealed to me in this was actually that there was no supernatural element to it at all, you know. But it's like,
were you tempted to inject one?
No, I wasn't.
There are moments in the film actually where Greta almost feels supernatural.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a moment where she's following Micah's character and Micah cannot see her for love nor money. That felt a little supernatural to me. As a filmmaker, you shape the film obviously three times, once in the screen in the script writing process, again in the editing stage. But on set, when you're making a psychological thriller like this, where you have a villain who displays many times in the film as she can pop up out of nowhere, that must be a lot of fun to exercise that sort of Hitchcockian muscle.
It's fun, yeah. I mean, it's kind of more in Roman Polanski territory, really, rather than Hitchcock, you know.
Okay.
But, I mean, what was satisfying about this movie, actually, is when I watch it, is that so much of it is constructed, so much of the story and so much of the fear and the kind of dynamic of the movie is constructed through the camera, you know? That's what was really interesting, actually, because it was that kind of challenge. You know, we end up in a tiny set, which we built in Dublin, two rooms, you know, a little kitchen off at a piano, and it's a matter of actually composition through the camera, you know, as to how fear and the camera movement, how the kind of the underworld or the under kind of tones of the story express itself, you know. That's what I really like doing, you know, because
how do you approach that? Do you storyboard or do you
no, you couldn't storyboard. Well, I suppose you could, but No, I just, you know, work out the shots and pursue them to the end, really, you know. And it's a bit like writing the script. You find out what the shot wants to be, you know, the kind of thing.
Is that something that has evolved over time? It's now, what, 37 years since Angel. So have you felt that you have changed as a filmmaker in that time?
Probably not at all. I'm probably still not a very good filmmaker.
Oh,
I mean, when I did Angel, I didn't even know anything about... I didn't know about complementary close-ups and the rules of cutting. All I knew was what I wanted to see through the camera, you know. Mm. And just that, I would be happy with that. And Chris Menge would say, you just need a bit more than that, Neil. I go, okay. You know, that kind of thing. So it was like... But I mean, the point is, if you make movies... I mean, I started as a short story writer. Mm. The only reason to make films is to construct images. You know, there's no other reason to be in the really tedious and exhausting business of filmmaking. There isn't really.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you don't want to construct something through that your eye can see, that you know, that has meaning and resonance and fear or, you know, sensuality or whatever, there's no point in being a filmmaker, you know.
Mm. Absolutely.
You know,
you mentioned there that the men are largely irrelevant in Greta, but one of the men,
Stephen, yeah. I know.
Your old pal.
Well, I mean, it's a very unforgiving part, that, really. But the scene where he dies, it was very critical to have somebody as adept as him to match his ability. Because I wanted to treat it as a dance, as a ballet, basically. But I chose a little piece of Chopin that she turns up to hide off to disguise the banging from the room next door. And I discussed with Isabel and Stephen playing this scene almost like a ballet, you know, that she would dance into the music and, you know, she'd dance to the music as the drug is taking hold and his consciousness is kind of going wavery and all that sort of stuff. But, I mean, you need a very good actor to construct even something as small as that. Do you understand what I mean? And that's why I wanted Stephen to play that role.
Is that something that leaps out at you when you're reading the script for the first time, or is that something that occurs to you as you're
adapting? No, it's not. It's not. I'm just looking for an actor who can do one very specific thing, you know. And you know, I've done much bigger things with Stephen. Obviously, I've done movies where he's been the center from start to finish.
Yeah.
But every now and then, I did a movie called Ondine years ago with Colin Farrell, and there was a part of a priest, and he had a function as a therapist almost, and to deliver a lot of humor and a lot of black irony to the story. And actually, I can only think of one person who could do that, be Stephen Ray. When I did Interview the Vampire, there was a part called Santiago, who had to do almost like a Fred Astaire dance, you know, up on under one of the bridges of Paris, and put on this Commedia dell'arte performance, you know, which was almost written in rhyming verse and couplets and all that, you know. There's only one person I can think who would deliver that would be Stephen Ray, you know, that kind of thing. So, I mean, the part he plays in Greta has got much less heft than those parts. But, you know, if I need something really specific, I do ask Stephen to do it, you know.
There's just something wonderful about seeing Stephen Ray in a Neil Jordan film. There's a very reassuring... I think there's a really, really lovely reassuring thing. I'm always fascinated with directors and actors who work together over and over again. You know, Hitchcock with Cary Grant and James Stewart, you know, De Niro and Scorsese, obviously.
Yeah.
Even John Wayne, John Ford, that sort of, Kurt Russell, John Carpenter.
Yeah.
And
Kurt Russell, John Carpenter. I didn't think of that. I love John Carpenter. Yeah. He's a genius, isn't he?
He's amazing.
I prefer him to Hitchcock. I'm sorry, I do. Is that a terrible thing to say? Is it?
I don't think it is. No, you're okay here.
I saw Christine recently. Fucking brilliant.
Christine's great.
Isn't it great?
Yeah.
Reassembling itself.
It's one of the lesser heralded John Carpenter films.
No,
but
it's great.
I think it's fantastic. But did you know, I mean, on Angel, did you know that this is a guy I'm going to work with again and again and again?
Well, no, I mean, if you think it was, I'm making an Irish movie, and there are very few Irish actors at the time. Oh, there were many Irish actors, but none of them had made movies.
Yeah.
I saw Stephen in a play, actually, that was directed by Jim Sheridan. It was called The Bloom of Cushla.
Okay.
And it had this noirish aspect to it, and I was looking at him and saying, that guy... He really seems like a movie actor, you know. So when I wrote Angel, I showed it to Stephen, you know. Mm. And so we kind of grew, we started exploring movies, the cinema together, really, you know. Mm. It's simple as that.
Yeah, we are, 37 years later.
Oh, my God, okay. Thank you. Thanks very much.
I should say 27. Okay. Anyway, I'll let you go. Neil Jordan,
thank
it's
you
been
very
an
much.
Absolute pleasure. Thank
okay,
you so much.
Thank you.
All right, well, let's start with Neil Jordan's Greta. So it's an unusual setup. Well, I guess no, it's not. It's a fairly typical setup, and then it goes in some unexpected directions. So Chloe Grace Moretz is Frances. So she's a young waitress living in New York, and she finds a handbag on the subway and returns it to its owner, who is Greta, who's played by Isabelle Huppert. So she's a piano teacher. She's a widow. She's kind of, you know, kind of isolated, doesn't have many people to talk to. So they become friends, you know, and it seems like this is a win for everybody. You know, we both need friends. We're kind of, you know, isolated in the city. But Greta begins to get a little bit too close for comfort. And then things get a little bit kind of weirder. And there are, you know, it gets to the point where Frances is, you know, she's kind of sheltered and she's not exactly a very outgoing, a very experienced or worldly person. So initially she's like, well, I guess this is just how things are. And gradually she begins to realize, no, this is not okay. And starts trying to kind of push back and you know, get protection, goes to the police, says, hang on, this is all getting a bit weird, and basically gets no help whatsoever. And then, of course, it all starts to go batshit crazy as Isabelle Huppert just turned into, well, an Isabelle Huppert character, but like dialed up to like 12.
This feels very 90s. It feels like it comes from that school of
sort of single white female.
Pacific Heights, that kind of.
There is a little bit of that, I think, going on. I think what's interesting about it is just how it amps up. Like, it starts quite, you know, contained, quite slow, you know, one of those sort of Isabelle Huppert kind of French thrillers, and then it just goes way off, much more than you're expecting.
You get dream sequences, you get all kinds of, it gets a bit overcooked, but also quite fun.
Yeah. I mean, it's really hard with these actresses not to just enjoy it.
It's Huppert being mega Huppert.
Mega Huppert. That's like, it's like Mecha Godzilla.
Yes, exactly. Mecha Huppert.
Mecha Huppert.
That's a film I would absolutely watch.
That'd be amazing. But yeah, it goes full on crazy at the end. So we gave this 3 stars, which I think is spot on, to be honest. Really, really interesting kind of setup, amazing cast, and then just kind of amps up the drama way super high by the end. So if you like that sort of thing, and especially if you're an Isabelle Huppert fan, this is definitely one for you. Now, what should we talk about next? I'm intrigued. This is a film I haven't seen, guys, but I know you both have. Dragged Across Concrete.
Yes.
What is going on? I have heard very conflicting things.
Yeah, so this is a Craig Zahler film. So he's the guy who brought us such gory masterpieces as Bone Tomahawk and Brawl in Cell Block 99, both of which are at terms genius and also absolutely horrific to the point of almost being unwatchable. And this, at first glance, isn't a kind of a video nasty type affair. So this stars Mel Gibson and Vince Vaughn as two cops who are very early on suspended for excessive force after stepping on a gentleman's head on a fire escape.
Ooh.
As you do. They then decide that they want to rip off a drug dealer, to rip off a criminal because they're suspended for 6 weeks without pay, they need the money. Long story short. So it's a kind of, in many ways, a classically constructed heist movie. Like, they set their eyes on a target, they set out to do the job, and then the job obviously goes awry. It's not really a spoiler to say that. What's interesting about this is a nearly 3-hour film.
Whoa.
And the setup and the execution is quite simple. And the reason it is so long is because there is an awful lot of background given to you. Like, every character is given room to breathe, they're given a backstory, you see their home life, their personal life, and it's a really interesting experiment in taking a simple setup and making you care about these characters on both sides by giving them so much of an inner life. And actually, it works really, really well. The only thing I will say is it is at times quite manipulative. There are points where they are clearly giving you backstory just to make inevitable bad things more unpalatable.
I mean,
when
one female character in particular.
Yeah, it's a little bit manipulative, but I think it executed very, very well. And the actual thing is really well constructed. It's very, very tense. It goes to areas you wouldn't necessarily expect it to go to. It also stars Troy Kittles, who played Leroy in Sons of Anarchy, which I'm rewatching at the moment. But it's like really, really great film. However, there is a slight problem with this, and I'm not sure whether this will ping on anyone's radar, but it is problematic in its treatment of race. That's not to say the film is massively racist, except the film is massively racist. And it's one of these things where the characters make racist comments. There's a part where Mel Gibson and his wife, you know, their daughter's having difficulty because she's being assaulted by local ruffians on the way back from school. And the point is made that, oh, you know, it's because we've moved to a black neighbourhood. She's being harassed by the blacks. And then, oh, maybe if we move to a white neighbourhood, and that's why he needs the money, so they can move to a white neighbourhood. And you're like, oh, okay, this is quite blunt racial commentary. I'll be interested to see what they do with this. Mm. But they don't do anything with it. It's just left standing there.
Oh.
So these characters are portrayed as racist, yep, but it's not relevant to the plot, and there's no addressing it. So it's just what they are. And then other characters also make racist comments, and then you start reading into it thinking, is this film just really racist?
That's the thing. It doesn't really feel like it's a commentary on the racism, because the film itself shows the scene where what they're saying seems to be backed up. That's what I had a problem with.
Right.
Because you don't need to have, you know, your lead characters be perfect, you know.
No, of course
they can be flawed, and you can have, you know, a racist character, but the problem is this film doesn't do anything with it apart from just portray almost all the characters as being quite...
Also, I think it's problematic if you have a scene where one of the characters going on a monologue that begins, "I'm not a racist, but..." and the other character is Mel Gibson. Like, in and of itself, that's really tricky ground.
That seems provocative casting.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, this film has had a very mixed reaction. A lot of people have given it good rating. I reviewed it for Empire, and I settled on 3 stars because there's so much craft, there's so much interesting stuff going on here. It's just a really interesting film. You're going to come out of this and want to talk about it.
Yeah.
And I saw it a couple of months ago, and I'm still talking about it. It's really interesting. And the last hour especially is really good filmmaking.
Incredibly
really
tense.
Unpredictable. Mm. Some really great twists. But I did have a real problem. It is very kind of sleazy, and there's some very horrible stuff that goes on. And it just, yeah, I had problems with some of the way the film itself portrayed things.
Okay.
It's deeply unpleasant in places.
Yeah.
It's what you'd kind of expect from the creator of Bone Tomahawk. Do you know what I mean? Like, it is, I mean, some of the gore and the violence in it is wildly over the top, but that's what Zoller does. You know, he's provocative in that way. And I think, you know, it's not off-putting. Like, Brawl in Cell Block 99 in particular, I thought was almost unwatchable. Not because it was bad, it's great, but it's so unpleasant that you just... I had to stop the film and just take a breather. It was quite traumatic for me. But
I mean, the way it treats the female characters as well is you know, the opening sequence, there's the guy who has his head sort of stomped on the sidewalk. He has a girlfriend who happens to be naked because she's just come out of the shower, and you have Mel Gibson and Vince Vaughn kind of standing around. She wants a towel. They won't give her one. And it's just got a very sleazy sort of... And that kind of carries all the way through the film with different female characters. And it's just... You come out feeling a bit just like, ooh, I'm not sure I like that.
Yeah.
The choices this film made.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that.
Is it consciously trying to be a throwback, do you think?
I mean, I don't know. I'm a big fan of Bone Tomahawk, and this actually made me sort of reappraise and go the way that that film treats Native Americans. And it didn't bother me so much when I saw it the first time. And then I was thinking, well, the way they're portrayed as just being sort of monsters, and I had some issues.
Yeah, the word I think is problematic.
Problematic.
Like, yeah.
It's unclear whether it's deliberate or not. And if it is deliberate, it's done perhaps a little too subtly. And if it isn't deliberate, then it's problematic. But either way, you know, with that in mind, with that in your head, it is, I think, a well-constructed thriller. And I think it's actually a really enjoyable film. But
within certain parameters.
Within certain parameters. Just have that in your head and, you know, try and approach it in your own way. But it is well done. Enjoyable is the wrong word, but it's a good film.
Okay, so we give it 3 stars, which is a recommendation. Okay, so then the other, I think, big-ish film out this week. I mean, for some reason, there's no massive blockbusters this week. It's almost like they're running scared of something coming out next Thursday, but that seems weird. Is Red Joan.
Who, of course, was the serial killer villain in a popular TV show, The Mentalist.
Was she?
No.
Oh,
that
okay.
was Red John. But
Red John, right, so this is her female. No.
So this is, tell us, Helen, what is Red Joan?
Red Joan is the story about an elderly pensioner who's played by Judi Dench, who is arrested and interrogated, and it turns out was a KGB spy in the years following World War II, and basically instrumental in helping the Russians develop the bomb.
Wow.
Yeah. So it sounds like it should be really cool, because it's basically you have, okay, you know, Judi Dench, first of all, you can't really go wrong, being interrogated and having to sort of relive her experiences during the war in the sort of the British equivalent of the Manhattan Project, basically, sort of working with scientists in Cambridge. Her younger version is played by Sophie Cookson, and she, you know, has her sort of doomed love affair with Tom Hughes, and basically gets kind of recruited to become an agent. And it's all in the name of idealism for her. It's all in the name of kind of peace, maintaining peace, because the argument is if everybody has these weapons, we'll all be safe, kind of stuff. But she, you know, gradually becomes sort of more and more compromised and sort of but gets away with it for decades until she doesn't anymore. And that's the sort of point we come to in the film. So really, really good performances in this. I saw this way back. I saw this way back last year at the Zurich Film Festival. Incredible performances from Dench and a really, really good one from Cookson, of course. But the whole film just feels a bit quiet, like it's still trying to be undercover. Almost, you know, it's really strange in that way. It just seems so low key that you almost don't quite know why you should care. Mm. It's directed by Trevor Nunn, who of course has a, you know, storied career in theater and so on, but it feels maybe just like he maybe didn't have the, I don't know, didn't feel comfortable going big enough. Yeah. Maybe with this.
How much Dench do you get? What's the kind of level of Denchness?
To be honest, I would probably put it about 30-ish% Dench and maybe 70-ish% Cookson.
Okay.
She is really, she's not quite just a bookend. They do come back to her during it. And she is more formidable than she initially seems as a sort of, you know, little old lady in a cardigan. But she's not the real focus of the story. It is the younger version of herself. So, yeah, so it's just a little bit too low-key for me, a little bit forgettable.
Catch it on the small screen kind of thing.
To be honest, yeah, I don't think you'll lose much by catching on the small screen. Some great knitwear, obviously. It's a story set in the 1940s and 50s. Yeah,
amazing knitwear.
Will Endgame have as good knitwear? Time will tell.
Almost certainly not. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we give it 2 stars, which is sadly not a recommendation. I didn't dislike it. I just, there's not much there to kind of cling to. So a little bit disappointing in that respect. All right, well, that's it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, when we'll be joined by Joe and Anthony Russo. I don't know. I think they made some TV comedy or something.
Helen,
I don't know what it is.
When we come back on the next podcast, we will have seen Endgame. Oh my God.
Let's go. It's fine. It's fine. We can make it.
We can make it.
We can make it. It's less than a week now. But yes, anyway, so we will be talking about any other films that are out next week. Who knows? Next week. It's very exciting. Until that auspicious occasion when we will have seen Endgame. It's goodbye from James.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Nick.
Goodbye.
And it's a toodaloo from me. I am off to investigate the physics of ring worlds. I will not rest until I understand what's going on in that shot in Halo, because it just doesn't make sense to me.